Good afternoon, Hong Kong. This is Sonali Figueres of Green Queen coming to you live from Garage Society Shangwan. Welcome to a zero waste journey live on air. I'm here with my host, Regina Larco of Hashtag Impact. We have an incredible episode for you today. Episode 5 in our series is going to delve into fashion waste and the circular economy. So I'm going to hand it over to Regina, who's going to introduce you to our pretty incredible panel.
Yes, a pretty incredible panel. It took me so long to actually get the intros together today because I was just so excited meeting you all. Let me introduce our superstar panelists today. Welcome Edwin Kay. He is the CEO of the Hong Kong Research Institute of Textile and Apparel, a leading center of excellence in research, development, and technology transfer in fashion and textile technologies. Edwin's expert insights are encouraging audience all over the globe to rethink supply chain operations. Many prizes and awards are proof of his impactful work. He is actually looking back at an incredible career as a senior executive with several US consumer goods and retail companies. Just to mention one, there were so many, Edwin, I just picked one. Until 2010, Edwin was working with the Walmart Group, Walmart Global Procurement. He managed sourcing activities in 50 plus countries. Today, he advises numerous corporates as well as social enterprises, NGOs, and industry groups. He is also teaching at multiple universities in Asia and the US, and in 2015 was listed in the Bread's 100 Most Influential People in Hong Kong. I can't believe you took the time, Edwin, to speak with us and be here today. He saw that in a talk that you gave, Edwin. Our beliefs are the most stubborn things we hang on to. So what do we believe about sourcing and how the sourcing world should operate? Edwin, welcome. Before we learn even more about how the sourcing world could and should operate, what are you most excited about working on at the moment?
Well, I'm very excited about being here and listening about all this stuff. But who's this person that you introduced? I'm very excited, and it's always a privilege in life to be able to participate and engage in exciting adventures that are meaningful, useful, and hopefully, if we do everything right, can change the world.
Right.
Inspiring thought.
We also welcome Hannah Hallin. She is sustainability manager at H&M Greater China, responsible for the sales markets of Hong Kong, mainland China, Taiwan, and Macau. Hannah's background, I thought that was also exciting, is actually in the nonprofit sector and includes roles, for example, at the Fair Trade Sweden. In a speech I found that you gave in 2015, a few years back, but I think even more relevant today, what you said that day about the fashion industry. You said, it's a very resource-intensive industry. It's very clear for anyone with an interest in sustainability that business, as usual, is not really an option. Hannah, welcome.
Thank you.
Today, can you give us a brief insight into what you're working on right now in your role?
Well, we are really excited to be part of this awakening we see here in Asia about a more sustainable lifestyle. So, of course, reaching millions and millions of customers and also tens of thousands of colleagues here to empower colleagues, customers to be part of a more sustainable fashion future. It's super exciting. Mm-hmm.
Last but not least, we welcome the incredible Sarah Garner, who is the founder of Retycle, Asia's first online consignment platform for buying and selling secondhand high-end children's fashion. For over a decade, Sarah worked with some of the best luxury fashion companies in Hong Kong. But then something happened, Sarah. After she had her first child, she wanted to apply her experience to a business with purpose, and Retycle was born. Sarah says, consider each fashion purchase with its afterlife in mind. Wear it, care for it, and then ensure it lives beyond you or your kids wear to lighten your footprint. Sarah, what is Recycle's vision all about?
So at Recycle, we're really aiming to make secondhand as good as new. I think that that's basically the idea behind what we're trying to do and change people's mindset about how they consume. So we're essentially trying to change a family consumption philosophy.
Mm-hmm. So exciting, Sonali.
It's so exciting. Every time you do the intros, Regina, I always learn something, even though I've done my own research. That was incredible. I can't believe we have such heavyweights on the panel once again. As we always do in the beginning of each episode, take a moment and put this issue, fashion waste and the circular economy, but first fashion waste, in a sort of global context. So everyone knows I love numbers, so let's start with some figures here. So fashion is a $2.4 trillion US dollar industry across the globe. It employs over 70 million people. We manufacture over 100 billion garments every year. 95 of those textiles can be recycled, but 3 out of 4 pieces of clothing end up in landfills. So just absorbing those numbers is a little bit scary. So if you're wondering why are we talking about this on the podcast and why is this one of the Zero Waste Journey episodes, it's because, well, fashion kind of is like food. We all use it. We all need to wear clothes. Whether we care about the clothes or not, we're still wearing clothes. What I also find fascinating about fashion is that it's an industry that touches everything. So it touches agriculture with cotton, flax, wool, for example. It touches mining with the metal and the stones. It touches animal husbandry with the fur, the silk, the leather. Petroleum with the plastics and the polyester. It touches forestry with rayon. Construction. Well, obviously retail shops and factories, it touches shipping, and obviously it touches human labor, manufacturing, we need a lot of humans to make it, over 70 million in fact. So what I wanted to do when I chose the panelists was get together three experts in fashion sustainability. They're all working towards a world that is better in terms of how we consume fashion and how fashion is made, but from a very different point of view. So Hannah, you know, you're very much coming, you know, with H&M, it's the mass market, the fast fashion kind of, let's say, inheritance and what we're gonna do about it. Edwin, obviously, of Hong Kong Rita, you're looking, we've got the technology and the innovation, which is gonna be a huge part of how we fix this problem. And then Sarah, you know, what you're doing is really changing consumer behavior and the circular economy is very much a key part of the ethos of Recycle. So the first question that I always want to ask is, you know, how did you become involved, all of you, in the fast fashion and fashion waste, the changing of the fashion paradigm? Why fashion? Why sustainability? Why now? Edwin, do you want to... Can we start with you?
Sure. I think that you touched on some of the key things about what is happening in the world today for all of us. We are consuming more and more. When we look at clothes, it is, as opposed to most everything else we use in the world, it's actually a deflationary product. Mm-hmm. There's a great chart that is... that comes out once a year on the Consumer Price Index. And if you compare, let's say, the last 20 years of the Consumer Price Index, in general, everything that we purchase have gone up about 55% in price, except for apparel. Apparel has gone down 4% during the last 20 years. So that means apparel has deflated 59%. So it has, today you buy t-shirts and jeans cheaper than you did 20 years ago, like for like. And actually it's a better product. So as a result of which, the affordability of clothes have become much better for most people. And unfortunately, because of that, consumption has become an issue. So my interest is trying to figure out what is a sustainable, reasonable lifestyle. How do we consume in a responsible manner, and maybe to a maybe make penance for all the sins that I've committed over the years and help people make stuff more accessible and cheaper. Right?
It's all about evolving and changing. While we still have you on the question, I would like you to know from your point of view, since you do obviously work at Hong Kong Rita, how serious is the problem in Hong Kong?
Hong Kong is a small city by global standards. We're about 7.5 million people thereabouts.
Right.
We throw away, according to the government figure, somewhere between 230 to 300 tons of apparel every day. So that is an incredible amount.
As in going straight to landfill?
Nobody really knows for sure, but let's assume that, let's say the first 100 tons are collected and reused and resold as secondhand, and then we have another, say, 50 tons of goods that are somehow got put back into useful use in some other form, let's say downcycled or something like that. We still have potentially somewhere on the order of magnitude 100 to 150 tons a day, either being incinerated or landfilled. That's a big problem.
That's a lot to consider. Which moves us to Hannah. How did you, so you were at Fair Trade Sweden, so obviously always had an interest in ethical consumption and ethical products. How did you end up with H&M?
Well, I mean, actually what my motivation was about 15 years ago, I started to do this kind of consumer awareness campaigns, going from classroom to classroom, really meeting young people, talking about sustainable consumption. It's the same motivation, really, to encourage people to use the voice they have to be part of the change. Because at that point, I mean, I was doing voluntary work both for Fairtrade, for Clean Clothes campaign, and eventually I was also a project leader in this organization. So we organized street side campaigns, we handed out at that time postcards. You could sign the postcard and send to the brand. Mm. So just use your voice to show that I'm your consumer. I want you to take your responsibility. So these are my expectations on you. So use that relation you have. I think that's so important, because the day you decide not to be a consumer with that brand, you also don't have that voice, that relation where you can actually be part of the change. So that was what we saw engaging and talking with young people, that just to have some kind of feeling of I matter to someone, instead of just feeling overwhelmed by all these figures you just mentioned about the size of the problem. For me personally, the connection also that I could influence another young girl's life on the other side of the world if I just picked this Fairtrade coffee in the supermarket instead of the conventional one. I knew that she or her parents had got a decent salary, and that she could have the choice instead of working to go to school, which would not be an option if the family needed or were dependent on their kids' work. So such a strong connection between my action and the impact you can have on the other side of the world for someone my age. So that was super motivating for me, and that's still what drives me. I mean, to be part of one of the world's largest fashion brands and retailers, you touch millions and millions of young women working in the supply chain. We have 1.6 million people employed by our suppliers. We have 170,000 colleagues in 70 different markets that don't have access to sustainable options or recycling options. Just to have this conversation, what can you do to be part of the positive change, instead of, once you realize the scope of the challenge we're facing, to just feel that it's too late, someone else did not fix this in time, and now we're all screwed. Because that's not the case. We can fix it, but we have to do it together. And that's really what...
You're coming from the
that's
activist. it's an incredible journey, and I like how you made that connection about our connection to everything we're buying and the impact we can have. Because, I mean, that's literally, at Green Queen, that's exactly what we're always talking about, vote with your dollar. I think the quote is from Anna Lapp or something, but it's certainly been bandied around for a long time. How responsible do you think a big fashion company like H&M is?
I mean,
for this problem?
For this problem already back then, 15 years ago,
right.
10 years ago when I was working for Clean Clothes, we benchmarked the different fashion brands to each other. H&M was leading already at that time. We were so impressed. They had 40 people employed full-time for sustainability.
Oh, you mean leading in a positive way?
Yes, and today it's more than 200 people that has sustainability as a core task within the brand. But for H&M Group, it's part of our business idea. So it's what everyone is supposed to and expected to deliver on every day you go to work. Fashion and quality at the best price in a sustainable way. Because we know we cannot be successful as a company or as an industry if we don't change the way we work. How fashion is made and enjoyed, it has to change if we're gonna have a successful industry within the planetary boundaries. So,
Interesting, because in a recent article by a fast company, H&M's numbers were shown to have dropped is significantly in the last year, and apparently one of the figures that was bandied around was you had 4.3 billion of unsold inventory sitting around because people are apparently not so keen on fast fashion anymore. The millennials, Generation Z, they're changing their consumer habits thanks to efforts by people like you. So what is H&M? Everyone you're saying goes to work at H&M to have a more sustainable, create a more sustainable relationship between the clothes, the consumer, and the manufacturing. But can it be ethical if we're if it is essentially a fast fashion company? I mean, do you have to raise your prices? Do you have to make it so people buy less?
It's a really important question, and you're really putting, I think, the finger on what so many people are asking themselves, right? Of course, it's not a great business case to have a lot of unsold inventory. Then obviously something has gone wrong in the planning. You cannot afford to waste those resources, neither for profit nor for the planet, that's for sure. Of course, what we want to do is to provide the best product at the best time to the people who wants it. And eventually, if people will want to buy fashion less the way they do it today, those business models, such as Retycle and others, will have to grow. But today, unfortunately, people's behaviors are not there, which means that if we as an industry just stop producing, or we as a company stop producing, people will still go and buy affordable clothes somewhere else where no one really looked into the supply chain. That's certain. We can definitely see, especially the Asian customer, being very price sensitive. And that's the challenge, I think. We need to change ourselves and together with our customers, change mindsets so to make sure that people buy what they love and that they care for what they have bought so that it gets a long life, so you know how you wash it, how you care for it, and the day you don't love it anymore, that you know what to do with it, which could be sell it secondhand, donate it to charity, swap it with a friend, or if you don't find another option, you can always come to our stores because we accept any textile, any condition, any quality, every day of the year, every store, every country where we have stores. And that's our promise, to make sure textile does not end up in landfill. And where we then sort it together with our partner for the best use, which could be rewear, secondhand, or it could be reuse for upcycling designers, or it could be recycled into fibers and made into new great fashion products, such as my denim, which is made from consumer, what our consumers brought back to our stores, fibers, cotton fibers. So I think that's the role we can take. That's where our size is actually part of the solution.
Right.
We can make sustainable fashion available and affordable to many people, and we can make a sustainable lifestyle attractive and easy, accessible to many people. And that's a unique role. I think a big, you could say, mass brand such as H&M has. That's our proposition that we try to work on. And then, of course, use AI, use modern solutions to be more accurate in our planning. Of course, we should not produce products that will end up not being wanted by anyone. So to be more accurate in our planning, of course, that must also be part of the solution. And AI is something we work a lot on from a sustainability perspective to enable that. But that's the real reason that we can take to...
Very interesting to get a kind of an insider view. Because I think it's easy to watch a brand from the outside and think, oh, they're talking about sustainability, but really... Is it serious? It sounds like it's very serious.
We cannot succeed alone. We have to do it with our customers. We have to go together as an industry as well. And we need innovations such as what Hong Kong Rita has to close the loop on the fiber so that old textile is an input for new.
Absolutely, so, we're definitely gonna delve into that. But you've mentioned Recycle. We've heard a little bit from Sarah. So Sarah, you came from a fashion background. Right? So, and now you are basically promoting this idea of the circular economy. So what does that mean to you? What is the circular economy for fashion?
Yeah, so in fashion, essentially it's keeping anything that's been manufactured in a loop. So extending the life cycle in some way, whether it's repurposed or resold. In our case, it's resale, so we're finding another use for an existing manufactured product, and that's our means of dealing with one part of the waste problem. And our part that we're focused on is kids, and kids are particularly wasteful, and we love, because you like stats, there's one stat that we find particularly jarring, which is that every child will outgrow an average of 1,700 items of clothing. And if you are a parent, you know that the lifespan of pretty well anything that goes onto your child is somewhere between 1 and 12 months. So it's a very short life cycle. It's a very particular problem, because even if you want to cherish something for ever and ever, you just can't with kids. It's not possible. So you have to consider the afterlife of every single one of those items. The problem is multiplied the more children you have, and so we're trying to be part of the solution and keep as many of those 1,700 items in circulation and create value between parents.
Okay, but let's delve deeper into your business model, because you also have a charity element. Right? So I think, if I understand, you sort through when people kind of give you their clothes to sell. So I'm a parent, I have all these clothes that my kid has outgrown. I want to make some money off of them and make sure they stay in circulation. What happens when they go to you?
Yeah, so we're part of what makes us different is that we do actually take the clothes from you. So
as opposed to
what many parents are doing, if they have real motivation and time, is they'll post on a Facebook group or they'll try to arrange a swap with friends, all of which are quite time intensive. So part of what we're trying to do is break down the barriers, which are typically time, for parents, and do all the work for them. So that makes us quite unique in what we're doing.
I think we should take a second there, because so you're making it easier for the consumer to make a more eco-friendly choice.
Yeah, I think because my background's in fashion, and I think I've been so close to consumers, I know that if you don't make it a desirable and easy choice, they just simply won't do it. Or there's a very small segment that has the willpower, the motivation.
The eco-warriors, we call them.
Basically, yes. The change makers. Yes. They're a small minority, but in order to get a mass adoption, you have to make the alternative attractive on many fronts. Ease, time, better price, more luxurious experience, better customer service. You kind of have to hit on multiple touch points to appeal to people who would otherwise do something different. And so what we're trying to do is not just appeal to people who would otherwise be buying on a secondhand Facebook group, but people who would otherwise be going to shop cheaply made baby clothes, because that's what they feel is responsible to do. Because why would you spend a lot of money on your child if they're only going to wear it for 1 to 12 months? So we're trying to provide parents with a price alternative to buying very cheaply made clothing. And we're just trying to make the experience really appealing.
So there's a luxury element to Retycle. You choose the brands that you want to display.
Yeah, so we curate, right now we have about 1,100 brands on the site and growing daily, and we try to benchmark brands that are of a high quality that we have tested in terms of their durability to make sure that the benchmark of the brand is something that can outlive 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 families.
Okay. And then, so the ones that don't make it, because you also have a quality control, is that right? You will sort for good quality, excellent quality, almost new, is that right?
Yeah, so one of the barriers to secondhand, not just in Hong Kong, but globally, is that it's fairly new to the general population. There's always a segment that has shopped secondhand, but for those that are new to secondhand, and even those who are already engaged with secondhand, there's always a concern about condition, quality, and authenticity. So our feeling is that if we can be an intermediary and we can provide that trust to the consumer, then we'll be able to convert a whole new segment of secondhand shoppers, because we're providing that trust that they would otherwise be missing on a peer-to-peer platform. So we do accept a tremendous amount of what comes into us, but we also have multiple charity partners. So we ensure that whatever is not accepted, if the sellers don't want their items back, then we have charity partners for those items to be placed with. So we have 100% placement with everything that comes in.
I think people, maybe they may not realize when they see your website, like how much thought and work goes into creating a circular economy experience that people will go for.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot that you're doing, and that there's a lot of forethought and a lot of insight into what will motivate the consumer to make the more eco choice.
I think a lot of that comes from, I'm not the only consumer of our products on the team. We have many moms on the team that are avid recyclers. But also, I just think about it from my own lens. I'm traditionally a high quality shopper. I want the best for my child. I want to be responsible in terms of our own family footprint. I want to keep all of our items in circulation. Like many entrepreneurs, this is coming purely from a personal use case, and it's a very challenging model to execute, but we're trying to be very thoughtful about it, and right now we're trying to figure out how we can bring what we're doing to the masses and scale our model.
Great. So Edwin, you're at Hong Kong Rita, which is funded by the Hong Kong government, right?
It's funded by something called the Innovation and Technology Fund in the Hong Kong government.
Does the government have, other than funding something like a Hong Kong Rita, a role to play in terms of regulation? In terms of changing consumer behavior and...
Sure. I mean, if you think about the current discussion about a levy on rubbish collection, trash collection.
The municipal waste,
yes,
solid...
Yes, municipal waste.
Yeah, solid waste scheme.
These discussions about, you know, should we build more landfills to deal with the problems that we have? How should we tax people who are buying more and more vehicles and creating more pollution? So I think in terms of regulation and incentives, there are lots of things that the government can do. But ultimately, I think it's a supporting role. A lot of what needs to change are very much. I mean, it has to come from us and from our lifestyle.
So what about, I mean, in terms of the, like, for example, the municipal waste scheme, that's about rubbish. Does it involve textiles as well?
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. We're trying to, so our intention, I mean, we're in the middle of a project with the support of H&M Foundation, in which we are taking anything that is heading towards landfill that has some sort of a fabric textile component to it, and they say, give it to us, we'll recycle, we'll upcycle it, we'll recondition it, we'll find new uses for it. So we do that. We are.
This is the textile mill.
Yes, this is the mill that we. This is
that you're working on.
we open up the mill. It's open.
We have a
3-ton a day output capacity on a woolen mill, and it's according to the chief executive, it's the first mill to be opened in Hong Kong in the last 50 years.
Wow.
So and that mill takes post-consumer waste and it reprocesses them. It's a mill and it's an experiment. We also have separation experiments going on in there right now about doing this more efficiently.
You mean with like robotic machines, that type of thing?
Well, the robotics and the color sortation are to reduce the amount of labor and increase the profitability. We want this to be a for-profit. We want to create a viable business model for people to reprocess post-consumer waste and make a useful, valuable product out of it and to make money out of it. So this factory pays rent, pays taxes, and has no special subsidies or anything from the government, and it is in business and it is shipping goods.
And it creates yarn, is that right?
It creates yarns. We would love it if it can create apparel, but there's no apparel factories left in Hong Kong. So the yarns are being created and are sent to be made into apparel in China. But on site are other research projects. We have another system in there, which we call the hydrothermal system, which separates mixed yarn. So one of the problems with high performance yarns that we use in apparel today is that it is blended. We blend lycra with cotton, with wool, with polyester. And once you blend stuff, you have to separate them before you can reuse them.
And why is that? Maybe our listeners might not know much about fashion manufacturing.
Because you can't process multi-source different yarns again. You have to separate them, otherwise it doesn't color properly, it doesn't perform properly. So a mono material is always the easiest thing to reprocess. And you can't separate at the consumer level mixed blended yarn. So we have a hydrothermal system which uses just heat and pressure to separate yarns back in their component. So polyester is cotton.
And am I right to understand that when you're creating the yarn from the post-consumer material, you do have to add some virgin fiber as well?
We do, because the good news about the system that we developed, and this is a world first we announced last year, is that it doesn't damage anything in the process. So whatever goes in is what comes out. So it depends on the quality of the input. So if you have high quality input, we can process this. We can use the same material over and over again. It's a truly circular system. Mm. But if the input material has been worn, you know, it's been in circulation for a long time and has weakened. We blend in some virgin material right now to improve its tensile strength and to its usefulness. Though we do also have another experiment going on right now that we are trying to strengthen old material without adding new material in.
Mm.
Solid state polymerization, for those of you who are geeks listening in, is the process that we're using to strengthen existing materials. And then there's another project to separate protein materials out of the, because today this system only works with cellulose materials, so cottons and linens and polyesters, but it destroys proteins, so wool, silks, and things like that. So we are building a new system that actually separates the proteins out before we put this thing through. And then we have the food waste to fiber project that we are.
Yes, that's with which university is that with?
City University.
So that's right.
Yeah. So
how far along is that?
We had a fashion show about 18 months ago of wedding gowns that we made out of food waste. And that's far along. We just need to commercialize it and create a bigger system so that we can get an industrial scale output. So
this could really be, expanded. You can really have clothes made out of food, because we have a lot of food waste. We did a whole episode
on
that.
So hopefully no government officials
last
listening
time.
In and tell you what we're doing right now. we are in the market, and we're actually in Germany right now in the market. We're buying a beer vat And then we basically what we do is we ferment things using enzymes, and then we turn that those back into amino acids and sugars and things like that, and then we polymerize them and use it into polyester. So it's a natural polyester process. But the easiest way to do that is in a beer vat. So we're telling the government we're buying a bioreactor, but between us, we're buying a beer vat. But we're not really making beer out of
it. Wait, so this would be a polyester that has no plastic in it?
Yeah, it's not a petroleum-based polyester.
I didn't realize you could have non-petroleum-based polyester.
We have been making PLA, polylactic acid, we have been making PET with this source, and
right.
We're now also making something called PEF, which is actually made from fructose, so fruits, which performs like a polyester as well.
So this is a great segue into my next question for Hannah, because you have this talk, I think it's the same one that Regina quoted you from, where you talk about how there's currently not enough recycled fibers on the planet to produce enough clothes for the demand, right? So are we moving, is it a realistic dream that one day everything that we make from, that's new, that's not re-put into circulation, like a Retyco model, that would be using some kind of recycled or post-consumer material? Is that realistic?
It's a goal we have set within 10 years, by 2030. Every material you find in any of our brand's products will be from a recycled or a sustainable source.
But sustainable is not the
yes,
same as recycled.
No, it is not. And the challenge on the recycled has really been the innovation. So it is fantastic to see only in the 2 years' time when we have used the money, the proceeds that H&M Group has got from the garment collecting we have in the stores, that has been donated to H&M Foundation to be invested in innovation for circular fashion, such as the Hong Kong Rita innovations. And the results you have achieved in only these first 2 years of the project is really encouraging, because what we need is a solution that is scalable. And the mechanical recycling, I mean, we have sold millions and millions of pieces of post-consumer recycled cotton products, but it's mechanical recycling.
What does that mean, mechanical
so that
recycling?
You shred the fibers. Oh, this is your part. You shred them. They lose quality, which means you need to blend in virgin cotton to keep the quality. You still want the quality product. Yeah.
We don't mechanically destroy the performance.
So when you use heat and water, basically, and what you used to call lemon juice, to separate fibers, you maintain the quality and potentially have infinitely recyclable polyester yarn.
So just to recap, mechanical recycling lowers the quality and the tensility of the fabric.
Yes.
So it makes long fibers into short fibers, so high-quality fabric and low-quality fabric. So you make carpeting and insulation and that kind of stuff out of mechanical.
So that's what's so exciting with this innovation. Some of the money was also invested in the Nobel Prize for Circular Fashion, we call it. It's the Global Change Award. It has been running 4 years now, mm-hmm. and this year 6,600 ideas were sent in from 182 countries.
Wow.
So there is, innovation is out there.
Wow.
The question is, do they get the investment they need? Do they get the knowledge to be scalable? Is there a demand from our industry to apply these innovations, to invest in them and make them part? So we have committed our goal, even if we don't know if it's reachable. We have said that by 2030, all materials must come from a recycled or sustainable source, to kind of send a clear message
that we are interested.
Hopefully to encourage investors, hopefully to encourage other brands in our industry to walk down the same road, because that's what's needed. The lack of ideas, that's not it. It's really to apply them. And 10 years from now, we might be wearing fashion made from completely different things.
Well,
whatever we are wearing today.
There's mushroom leather, there's
yes.
pineapple leather, there's
so
tofu leather, kombucha
these
leather.
These girls and boys that have come up with some of these innovations are in Hong Kong right now, this week, in our office, getting training, and they will be speaking tomorrow at an event. So it will be super exciting to share this news with the fashion and textile industry in this region as well, because what you say, they make fashion from agricultural leftovers, from algae, from mushroom roots.
Oh, so some of these people, they're in your office
yes,
right now?
Yes. So they exist. You are trying out some of the other available innovations here in Hong Kong. I think that's a super exciting place to be right now. We are very hopeful, but it was a bold and audacious goal. Because just what you say, I mean, we are already, since many years, the world's largest buyer of the organic cotton, of recycled polyester from PET, of Tencel, which is made from FSC-certified eucalyptus wood.
Right.
And still, you go into our store and you're not overwhelmed by all the green hang tags on all the products because you don't really see them. But today, actually, end of last year, 35% of all the material within H&M Group was from a sustainable source. But we have to go towards 100, and that road is not visible. We just know we have to find it. And that's why it's so exciting to work and to see these innovations coming up.
Yeah, you mean, look at Adidas. They've also committed that all their products will be made from recycled plastics by 2024.
Right.
So since you guys are the innovation and experts, let's give our listeners some hope. What do you think realistically we'll see in the market within the next 5 years that are addressing these problems? Like, what are the most promising? Obviously, beyond the recycled plastic bottles.
Mm-hmm.
Highly efficient recycling processes that can maintain the performance and the characteristics of the virgin material. Much more intelligence in purchasing and in distribution. So
the planning that she talked about,
that
Hannah talked about.
We make what we sell and we sell what we make.
I think we need to bring up Burberry was in the news for this really recently, right? And this created a huge scandal because a lot of consumers did not realize that luxury brands like Burberry would actually burn their stock. I mean, I don't know if you want to speak to this, Hannah, but is this a planning issue? Just a planning issue for them that they owe?
I'm not from the luxury industry,
but
it's clear that we are aware that, of course, they, for brand protection reasons, have a bigger challenge than we do. We sell what we make. We just put it in different markets, put it at a different price point. We do everything we can. We move the products, you know, between stores to make sure that they sell. We can sell them at some point. It's better, you know, that they get a life. We don't allow incineration. If we would have any leftover, whether it's customer returns or anything, we strictly sort them according to the waste hierarchy. So
the
charity,
unsold inventory that we mentioned, you take it back and you do something.
That is at a given date, you know.
Right.
It doesn't mean that at that date everything is, put into a landfill.
Okay.
No, we don't allow that.
You don't allow that.
That's not in line
that's
with
really
our
important
policies.
To understand.
Yes. But of course, that's important figures for investors and others, shareholders, to know.
Right.
If we're facing such a challenge.
Good clarification.
Yeah,
okay.
But of course, we sort it always according to the waste hierarchy. So you donate or you recycle. I mean, we have ICO, the big one of the world's leading recycling companies that can sort it in a transparent way to make sure it gets a second life. And only if it's moldy or if it has not passed some chemical requirements testing, then we could allow incineration for energy. Only those orders. And this is something we monitor and follow up. And for luxury industry, I know they have another brand protection.
Well, Sarah, you come from a luxury background. Did you know that Burberry was doing this?
I didn't know Burberry in particular, but it's a very pervasive, known fact within industry.
Really?
Yes. So we...
You were not surprised.
Of course, no one in the industry is...
admitting it.
Willing to or incentivized to talk about it. But at some of the companies that I worked with, there was a policy of destruction. So
a policy of destruction.
Yeah. So we would have to prove essentially to the brands that their remaining stock had been destroyed. So there would be photo evidence. This is a very common practice. practice because consumers were not aware, and therefore consumers weren't putting pressure on the brands. So now, of course, as soon as I think we haven't talked a lot about consumer education, but I think a lot of the efforts that we're making, all of us collectively, is not just in solutions, but it's also in education. And so as soon as you can educate a consumer about the problem that they're facing or the problem that they're contributing to, then they're much more likely to use that information towards their decision making. And luxury brands have a particular problem, and I think H&M is in a better position in this realm because discounting is part of the, it's not going to detract from the brand. That's actually better for the brand if you can offer a better price to the consumer, whereas for luxury brands, they're very protectionist about their brand because if they don't have that position and stature, then they can't charge the prices that they do. Many of those brands don't mark down at all. And so typically they would have friends and family, very closed sales that are not harmful to their reputation. And then, that's something I've been privy to for a long time. And, was in charge of the whole life cycle of product in many of my positions, and so I knew this was a problem for brands. Brands don't want to destroy product, of course.
Okay.
It's not good for their business. No one wants to do it, but it's more important to them to protect their image. So in our small way, we're trying to solve for that for kids brands, because what ends up happening for these luxury brands is that they can't find the appropriate partners. They can't find partners for their off-price goods that don't detract from their image, that will add to it. And so part of our positioning is to invite brands to sell with us while adding to their image. So we're presenting their products in a very safe environment. They're presented in the same light that they would on their own websites, in the same image, aligned with their discount pricing, and we're adding to their brand value because we're saying you are an environmentally conscious brand if you sell with Verticale. So we're trying to encourage brands that would otherwise find less attractive ways to get rid of their off-price items to have a safe and
so an overstock solution in a sense.
Yeah.
For a more luxury
yeah.
brand. And so you've got, you know, your counterparts like Vestiaire Collective, you know, they are offering what you do but for adults and for accessories. So you must still have contacts in the luxury fashion industry. What is luxury fashion's response to, you know, since they want to control their brand image, what do they feel about the pre-love, the secondhand market, this new way of doing business, the circular economy? Are they open?
I think they're confused. They don't know. They don't know whether to get on board and be enthusiastic and be cheerleaders or to treat resale as the enemy. Obviously, everyone wants something. If there's a new business model, they want to think about how it will positively impact them and how they can mitigate the damage. And so I think the brands are unsure of whether to align or whether to create their own programs. So I think there's a bit of a...
So we're in a flux with
the
luxury brands.
They
don't know yet.
They're falling into different categories. They're either ambivalent, they're feeling quite against, or they're feeling that they should really be aligning. And there are some brands which, of course, Patagonia, which is always in the limelight of being an environmentally conscientious brand, has their own resale platform, and that's gaining in popularity. Eileen Fisher has just launched their own resale campaign, and it's starting to evolve where the brands, where they're feeling that this is a good thing to be a part of, some of them are actually incorporating it into their own structure.
So there is a future of where brands will have their own resale platforms. Interesting.
It's already starting, yeah.
Okay. And do you believe that there is a future where we're all buying secondhand? I mean, Is that a true possibility eventually one day?
I think secondhand is only part of the solution. I think there's always going to be a place for purchasing new. But as Hannah's saying, if you can have sustainably sourced products that are from recycled materials, ideally, I think it's just about making conscious choices. So secondhand is part of the solution in that. As Regina quoted in the intro, I believe you have to think about the afterlife, not just for clothes, but for a table, for chairs. When you make a purchase decision, whether it's food, you have to think about the wrapper, that something's come in and what you're going to do with that wrapper. I think that's where we're heading, is just being conscientious about that first point of purchase and what will you do with it once it's finished your useful life with you.
I mean, so I open this up to all of you. I asked Sarah, but can fashion's supply chain truly be zero waste one day? Is this a realistic goal?
We're doing an experiment right now at the Mills project. We opened up a shop, and in the middle of shop, with the H&M Foundation support, we put a 40-foot container, and we are telling consumers, come bring your old clothes. And in the 40-foot container, we take the old clothes and we process them back into yarns and fibers, and we 3D knit them new clothes. And the idea we're trying there is twofold. So one, for a place like Hong Kong, it's wardrobe management. You want to buy something new first, let's get rid of something old, right? And then the other model is to work with designers and say, well, why don't you stop selling clothes? Why don't you start selling designs of clothes? Come and work with us, input your design into our 3D knitting machine. Consumers will bring their own raw material, and we'll put your label on it, and we'll figure out how you can make money with it. But there, here we have a digital model of what fashion could look like. So I think there are different ideas. There are different ways to think about fashion. To answer the question you asked earlier, is basically what will fashion look like in the future? Some of it could be manufactured on demand. Some of it could be materials that are used again and again. Fashion is fast, and it's always new. But materials can be used over and over again for many times. So if we decouple the two, then perhaps there are new business models.
The ambition we have set is to become 100% circular, and that means that we need to look both at us how fashion is enjoyed and how it is made.
Right.
And one of the challenges we were facing, even if you use a recycled material, such as the recycled PET turned into polyester or old fish nets, what do you do after life? Because that shirt won't biodegrade in
a
very long time, if ever. So
you can't break that down again.
Now you can. So now there are innovations for this, and that's part of the solutions that is tested now in the woolen mill here in Hong Kong. So those are the exciting things we see, that once they will be available, you can consume fashion, use fashion to express who you are, your identity, also in a world with a 10 billion population, right? When the resources are scarce, when we cannot rely on the too cheaply priced commodities and natural resources, which we do today. I mean, whatever we're wearing today, it requires the water, the oil, the land, something. This is available for all industries, not just fashion, too cheap. I mean, these resources will be needed to feed the planet of 10 billion people, most likely. And then we need to look at other inputs to make fashion. People will still want to wear clothes, they will still want to express who they are. So to cut that dependency from extracting natural resources, turning that into fashion, having that ending up as waste, we need to go to circular. So we keep reusing the resources we have in different ways. One loop is the second-hand loop, swapping loop, upcycling, redesigning, remaking. And then you have one which is a fiber loop, which is reusing the fibers over and over again with maybe minimal inputs, or circular inputs of water, heat, and some of these things. So those are the different solutions we see. And for us, we see that our responsibility really is the life of a product, and the impact on the planet, we know, happens a lot in the material phase. So how material is grown or processed and turned into fabric, that's where we see a big impact on energy, water, pollution. And then we know the day the customer comes to our store and leaves with our product, after that, big impact on the planet. The way you wash it, hot water, the way you will you hang dry it or dry it using a lot of energy in a tumble dryer.
The microfiber
will
issue.
Will you care for it? Will you follow
which we
the,
covered in
yes,
our
exactly.
in our first episode, which was an eye-opener. I didn't know that myself, so that's...
So provide that type of advice we see as our role as well, and inspire people to keep their clothes clean and to know which material you can, you know, like silk and wool, you can let them self-purify, to, so to say, you don't need to wash them as frequently as some other materials. And these kinds of lifestyle inspiration and habits we want to provide. And then people will love and care for the clothes longer so that they stay in the loop. I think that's really, that has been the challenge also, the day you don't love your clothes anymore, that we are responsible for what happened with that t-shirt when you don't want it anymore. That's why we want to provide an easy solution for you to bring it back. And it can be your bed sheet, towels, underwear, whatever, textile. Don't let it go to landfill, because it is a resource, it's an input for new great fashion. And that's the way we can close the loop together. So.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think we can be very ambitious about this. I mean, all that we've talked about so far is doing less bad. How can we consume less, how can we be smarter? There's the other side of it, which is more good, which is how can this be carbon positive? How can this be something that uplifts economies and make the world a better place? I think there's a lot of opportunities there.
Well, I think we're talking about things like food waste, which we have the problem anyway. We're not going to stop consuming food,
right,
so
right,
food
right.
waste isn't going to go away
right.
to a certain extent. That's very encouraging.
Yeah, but how can we use this industry to clean up some of the things, some of the damage we've done already? How can we make it so that we actually consume less of the non-renewable resources? I think there's a lots of ways in which we can radically rethink this. At the end of the day, look, if we in this room announce a moratorium and say, okay, from this day onwards, none of us are allowed to buy new clothes, none of us will starve or freeze to death this winter, right? You know, we'll be fine. And so we buy because we want these things to make us feel good. And beyond the aesthetics, it has to be what do wearing these clothes stand for? What are we saying when we wear clothes like this? And this is where, you know, sustainability and good secondhand clothes things that are manufactured in responsible, good manufacturing environments all make a difference, right?
Absolutely. Those are beautiful words to
yes.
end on,
yes.
Regina.
You actually answered the last question I always ask on Hashtag Impact Podcast, so I'm not going to ask it again. But then what could everyone do right now to make the world a better place? Like, because we all have a role to play, and we actually do have, and that's so empowering. I always love that we actually have, with our decisions we make, with our research we do, with the clothes we wear, where we buy, we are actually making an impact.
Yeah.
So you actually already answered my most favorite question of
I
all.
Know at the end this was an incredibly uplifting episode, because so many solutions, and I think from all of you I'm getting a real sense of optimism about the future for the issue of fashion waste. I think that's fair to say. You all are part of the solution, and you're all, you know, positively looking at the future.
Yeah.
I think, yes, I mean, the shirt I'm wearing is my mom's old H&M shirt. I have so
I
many memories of this.
Why did you comment on the
shirt?
Yes,
you like
it's a fabulous
it's
shirt.
It's
so
a audio.
Yeah.
But really, I grew up in Sweden, so we have a lot of space. My mom just has boxes. So for my babies, I just open the box, with my name from like 1982, and I could provide a full order.
You go shopping
for my mom, for my baby.
Wow.
Yeah, this is where in Asia we don't have as much space.
That's where we need Ritaika. Someone else hosting the wardrobe management.
Wardrobe management. I like that term, which you are the solution for, Sarah. We just need an adult solution as well. And we also probably need to buy fewer clothes overall. Thank you very much, everyone. What an incredible discussion. I think everyone who's listened has learned a lot of things. I certainly got an education. And especially, I want to shout out to one more thing, because we talk a lot about sustainability in fashion, but I think there's another thing in fashion that's really important to talk about, and H&M is taking the lead on this, and that's the ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to quickly say a couple words, Hannah, on what you're doing with the ACT Action Collaboration and Transformation?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we know we have been working 20 years to make sure that human rights are respected in the entire supply chain. It has been a lot of mistakes and learnings over these years. One of the bigger learnings is you cannot fix this alone. You can be one buyer or two buyers with a lot of high expectation on working conditions, the ability to democratically organize on the factory floor. And negotiate your wages with your manager. These are the, we call it the Swedish model. That's what helped Sweden to actually get more social security in place. We, as a Swedish company, we fundamentally believe that giving the worker voice and influence makes a difference. But the problem was we had to work across the whole industry. You cannot do it only factory by factory, one brand having this expectation. So we have come together, and we call it ACT, together with our, you could say, our competitors, I mean our peers, like-minded brands that share the same ambition. And we have done this together with the Industry All, which is the global union, having the local trade unions as their members. And this way we can find a more systematic and a more long-term change happening in the textile industry, and we have focused a lot on Cambodia, and we will share some of the results of this first 5 years now, end of this year. So keep your eyes peeled.
For those who are listening, what it essentially means is that all of these buyers and brands and big manufacturers have agreed to basically bear the higher costs of providing better salaries and wages and conditions for all factory workers across the world. So this is a huge leap. And I think when we talk about sustainability, I love that discussion, but I think sometimes we also forget about the human element. So I thought it was important to bring that in.
Yes, I think, and it hasn't been the cost that is the key problem. The problem is to find the system and the solution and make it long term, not just add money and problem solved, because it has to be a democratically organized solution for the workers to be part of it. So that's so exciting to see.
Fantastic. Well, thank you all very much for joining us on this Wednesday afternoon. And we look forward to seeing all of your solutions and innovation in the market and being able to help be part of the solution by voting with our dollar.
Yes, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.